for a while now, I've been trying to understand what we're doing here. As I've expressed on a number of occasions, there is nothing to do. So to gather together, to try to do nothing, is kind of insane. And yet, that's what's happening. We call it meditating. And meditating is really trying to stop doing. You force yourself to sit still. You do an exercise, whichever exercise you're given by whichever teacher you find, to try to get you quiet. And that quiet is trying to release you from everything that makes you who you are. And yet, in some secret agenda that everybody has, you want the benefit of that quiet to take out of the room with you. Excuse me. In other words, you want to own and have that stillness as a benefit in your life. And the benefit that you want is that it will make your life better. It'll get you a better job. It'll make you a better lover. It will make you a sweeter personality. Whatever your particular agenda is, somehow there's a cost-benefit ratio here. You're going to come and get this thing which is nothing and take it with you and make you something. And it doesn't work. It simply doesn't work. It does work in a certain sense, that in some incremental way, when you sit still, the stillness starts to permeate. It starts to deepen. So you start to feel more of yourself in the process of the class than you might feel if you went out to dinner with friends or went to the bar. You really start to feel something going on inside, you start to feel depth, or you start to feel conscious, aware, present, and it's really very wonderful. And I suspect those of you who are here, because I don't work with anyone here who doesn't get a connection. One of the things that happens excuse me, in this class, is a connection is made between you and the self. And everyone who connects with themselves loves it. Because it's all you want. All you want is to connect with yourself. And in a class like this, with a teacher who is an empty vessel, really, you're really just connecting with you. And when you connect with you, you feel at peace and at home. You feel finally. And then you want to run out into the day, into the night, or whatever, whenever you leave the class, and carry that with you as though it's transportable, as though you can now take this sense of connection to wherever you happen to be running off to. And the truth is, you can. You can, because it never really leaves you. But what happens when you leave this class, for most of you, is that you leave it behind. You leave the connection behind. You go, okay, I had it. Off you go. And it's really kind of interesting. I mean, I literally watch people leave the classroom and run out the door. Run as fast as they can, almost, and forgive me, I don't mean to be personal here, but a lot of you turn as quickly as you can and leave it in the room. And that's not how it works. You can't really leave it. All you can do is turn away from it. And you turn away from it because you just don't realize that it's not something that you can have, it's something that you are. And when you turn away from it, you really turn back into, in a sense, I'll say, what you are not. You turn into personality. You turn into the person absorbed by and totally caught by the day-to-day life. And you jump back into that with a kind of fury, with a kind of total thrill and commitment, back in the world again, back in the noise, back in the drama, back in the stuff of day-to-day life, which most of us find completely compelling and enchanting, until it's not. And when it's not, you go, get me out of here, and where can you go? You come back to this, because this feels like a release from that. I've watched most of you now, for some of you for decades, and I watched this ballet go on. Come and get this thing, and you do get it. There's nobody here who doesn't get it. And I watch you turn away from it. I don't do it with judgment because I watch myself do the same thing for as long as you and longer. I would come and get the energy. I would feel ennobled by the energy. I would feel expanded by it. I felt spiritualized by it. I felt really wonderful. And then I would go off into the day and I would try to perpetuate it as long as I could. But of course you can't perpetuate it because there's nothing you can do that has anything to do with it. All you can do, really, is, well, the verb to do is the problem. There's nothing you can do. You can just be. And learning how to be is really what we're doing here. Learning how to be. And of course that's absurd, because you know exactly how to be. Every one of you has mastered this a long time ago. You know how to be. You keep misidentifying being with doing. You keep thinking, if I do this and do that, I'm being. Not true. Being is without action. Being is stillness itself. It's motionless. It's totally free, totally unencumbered. It feels like being in love. It feels like being a good person. It feels like joy. It feels like comfort. And it's always right there. But the minute you escape into doing, whatever it is you're doing, you turn your back on being. And you don't have to do that. It's just a pattern. We just do it. We've always done it. And then there comes a moment, if you're given this grace, where doing falls away. Where the person who's doing is gone. And the path to that moment is called the pathless path, because there's no way to it. It just happens. On the other hand, most of the people for whom that happens have been trying to be. So as much as you can't achieve it, the trying appears to be a necessary ingredient. And the trying in this case is coming to a situation like this. A classroom full of other people sitting with seriousness of purpose, asking deeply inside for help to surrender, which means help to not have to do. Help to just be. And in fact, every one of you during the course of the class achieves it. Every one of you. There's nobody sitting here who didn't have a moment or an extension of moments where you weren't completely there. So what I'm beginning to understand is that this is valuable. Because what you taste in this class, and what you sometimes take away with you and sometimes don't, and sometimes keep with you for a period of hours or even days, is exactly what I'm talking about. And so when this final moment of release occurs for you, and it will be deeply familiar, because it will feel like what you feel when you sit here. You will say, oh, that, of course, that's all it is. I am what I am. The personality is no longer an issue. The drama of your day is no longer terribly important. All of the stuff that preoccupies you is just suddenly not there. But you're there. You're still there. And you feel what you feel when you're sitting in this class. Only it's there permanently. It doesn't leave you. You may leave it. I've talked about this in the past, what I now call this thing brucing. And you know, you can give it your name. It's this thing where you suddenly become sort of caught back up in the world for a moment, but it doesn't last very long. And a lot of times it's created by other people, because they come and demand that you be that person. So you just be that person. It's not hard. You've been doing it for decades. You know how to do it. You just do it. You go to a dinner party and you be that person. You're charming and you're fun and you're easy, and there's no effort. You actually become a very good dinner party person, or a bar person, or whatever kind of person you need to be. You become that because it's not hard to do. But as soon as that's over, there you are again. There's you. This perfect, happy, at home being. If I went to most people on the street and tried to talk to them about what I'm saying right now, they would not have a clue to what I was talking about, probably. There may be a language for it, there may be a way to get to them. But it's much easier to talk to you. And it's much easier to talk to you because you have been sitting here for the past hour, reaching for, and in some moments, arriving at this place of absolute serenity and being. So when I allude to being, something in your brain goes, oh yeah, that. That's a gift. It's a gift because there's somewhere in your mental capacity a language for something that's very, very obscure. It's really not obscure, because ultimately it's the essence of every human being on the planet. But it's obscure to almost everyone on the planet because we live in a state of almost total distraction. And we choose to. We absolutely choose to do it because the world is so completely fascinating. But we're in this world in a state of fear. And I was playing with my granddaughter the other day, and I had this realization or recollection of being her age, in a sense, and lying there completely helpless and having no ability to communicate with anybody other than crying, which says, I don't like this. That's what crying is. I don't like this. I want it different. That's all you can do. And she and I were playing, and I was playing with her. It was really a wonderful moment. She, that day, learned how to reach for something. And I kind of watched how she needed to do it, and we did this very slow motion, providing her with a toy way above her, and her looking at it, and her hands went really slow like this, and then, you can't see me on camera, but the hands just come together like that, and then the object arrives. And the joy of that moment, the celebration of that moment is enormous. Accomplishment is enormous, and you get really thrilled by the reaction of the people around you. I couldn't help cheering every time she did it. And she would go, oh, I did it. She doesn't know what she did, but she did it. And she kept doing it, and I could tell after about 20 minutes of this, she had it down. She was reaching and getting. And she felt empowered and thrilled and joyful, and the world was celebrating that. And then she was bored. On to the next, whatever the next thing is. And the next thing, I didn't know what the next thing should be. And here was this person playing with her who knew everything and who she trusted to give her this moment. And now this person was useless, didn't give her anything she wanted, didn't have a clue whether she wanted to be lifted up or taken or held or turned this way or turned that way. I had no idea. And that moment is the moment I remembered being her age. And I remembered, I don't trust these people. They don't know what I need. I remember my mother loved me, which was very valuable because a lot of people don't even get that. I knew she loved me, but she didn't get me. She was not going to be there 100%. She was going to be there occasionally. And something in me had to figure out, what do I do now? What do I do when she doesn't get me? I cry. And then she tries 12 different things that don't work, so I go, she really doesn't get me. And then I have to go, crying's not working. I'm expressing everything I know how to express, and it doesn't get anywhere. I have to let go. I have to deal with not having, with the world not recognizing my needs. Some people do that, and a lot of people don't do that. Some people build a level of distrust and a lack of safety into the network that's there until you come to a class like this. So when I sit with you, something is going on that goes back to that first few months of your life. Somewhere in there, you said, I don't trust this thing. I can't rely on them, I have to rely on whatever. And everyone has a different configuration of this because we all had different experiences. But I was with a friend last night who's a psychiatrist who says, when somebody walks into his room and starts to tell the story, he knows immediately their first 2 years of life. He knows what went wrong. Then the trick is, how do we get back into that and repair it? How do we fix it? What you're looking for in life is to find a space, we'll call it of safety, but it's really a place where you're known, where you are acknowledged, where you are recognized, where your needs are met. And some people look for it in a relationship, in a marriage, in a friendship. There's a lot of places we look for it. Sometimes it really works. Many times it's only partial. But ultimately, you come to something like this, which is a place where you learn to ask for help to surrender. And asking for help to surrender means letting go of the need for anybody out there to get you, or understand you, or take care of your needs. Because 99.9% of the time, they can't and they won't. So how do you get your needs taken care of? It's magical. You suddenly realize you don't have any needs that are not being met. That you are in your space of self, completely met at your own level, totally understood, totally accepted, totally embraced, and at one with you. At which point, nobody outside you ever needs to give you anything. You don't require anything from the world other than to love it. For you to love it. What happens when you finally awaken is you become the compassionate, loving, embracing entity that everyone is looking for. And all you're doing is reflecting back themselves. That's all you're doing. You are emptiness itself, reflecting back the very thing that everybody wants. And that's what a teacher is, or a guru. It's the empty space of you that you're looking into and finding complete satisfaction within it, complete joy within it. So you come to a class like this, hopefully with a teacher who has connected to that, and everyone who sits here in some way connects to that. Some perhaps more completely than others, but it doesn't really matter. What matters is, for the period of time when you're sitting with somebody and looking into the eyes of the other, you're looking into your own eyes, and you're being loved and accepted and acknowledged and cared for and satisfied in a way that will not happen probably in any other form in this world unless you've married somebody perfect or have the perfect friend, which can happen. Once you are free of the need for the world to give back, you become free to give. And the greatest joy I have ever come upon is that, just to be. And what I discovered, as I've talked about quite a bit now, is I had nothing to do. The only thing I do, in a sense, is I sit here and be. So the obligation in my brain to sit here and be is pretty solid. And as long as you guys come and sit here, I will be here. Not every week, obviously, but somebody will be here. And that being has within it the capacity to bring you back to your own being. And that's all it does. And during that process, and it is a process, chunks of you will keep falling off like icebergs collapsing into the sea. Every time you come here, a part of you will fall off. If you live consciously during the day, more and more parts of you will fall off. You will start to become part of that process. You will start to chop off stuff that no longer works for you. Don't need that. Those friends over there, they've been causing me grief for 20 years. Gone. Everything you don't need goes away, and then there's nothing you need at all. You free yourself of all of the stuff of life until everything you are and everything you think you are diminishes and then leaves you. It's a journey that's pretty predictable. As you get toward the end of it, you're going to start to feel saintly. You're going to start to feel like a good person. You're going to feel like someone who gets how you have to behave in the world. And I will tell you, that's the last trap. Being a good person, a saintly person, is as bad as being anything else, because it's still a hold on something separate from you. I would advise you, examine your life as you go through it and realize anything you're holding on to, whether it appears to be good or bad, is not what you are. It's just something you're holding on to. It's your safety in a world that has no safety. Let it go. Just let it go, let it go. And finally, the universe will go, and it will be over. The last chip will fall away, and there you are. I also watch people hold on to ignorance. I once told Rudy, I said, Rudy, I just don't understand something. He said, you choose not to understand. A lot of us live that way. I can't understand it. It's too beyond me. I'll never get it. Well, that becomes your identity. You'll never get it. And you won't. I mean, you will, you know, somewhere, but not in that moment. You have to, if you do come here, want what you are here for. If you come here because you want to have an identity of someone who comes to meditation or yoga, well, then you're just building another identity, and it will be a waste of time. I mean, it's not a complete waste of time, because I will still do the work on this end. But you may not take it away from here. You may not use it. You may not arrive at it. So, find in yourselves the reason you're coming here, the part of you that needs to be here. Acknowledge it. Bring it into the room, sit down, ask inside as deeply as you can to be, or for help to surrender doing, and let it wash over you and let it do its work, and it will work. And every one of you will one day wake up and there will be no you there. And you will be happier than you can possibly imagine, and we will share a friendship that will be beyond anything you have known before. It's just waiting. It's just waiting. It's totally up to you. You really have to say, this is it. This is what I want. This is what I want. I've said this before. The universe will give you what you want if you know what you want. And it will move time and space to give you everything. But if you are saying, I really want to awaken so I can be famous, and I can sell a million books, or whatever, it will probably give you that, given time and effort. But then what you really wanted was to be famous and to sell a lot of books. If you really want to just be free, let it know that. Let yourself know that. Let yourself understand why you bring yourself to this week after week after week. Why do you come here? Be clear about it. Be clear about it for yourself. Let yourself know what you're after, and yourself will give it. You will get exactly what you want. And it's just waiting for you to happen. So commit internally, in depth, to this practice or this hunger or this need, and you will be amazed at what will be delivered. Any questions?
Can you do that and sell books and make money and
yes.
be famous?
Can you do this and sell books and be famous? That may happen, but it's not because you wanted to sell books necessarily. I mean, it could be. It could be. I mean, what you understand in a real, as you awaken, is that you're the totality. So you are the massive, infinite, endless truth of being, and you're this little component of it that's somehow, at this moment in time, voicing it, sharing it, speaking it. And it's going to have its own journey. And its journey will complete you on some level. But it won't be because of your particular need and desire at that point. It'll be because of what it is or what it wants to be. That's kind of how it happens. If you really wanted to do it for the money and the fame, and that gets delivered to you, the other process will be incomplete, especially if you identify with it. That's all I can say.
But we all need to pay rent and stuff.
Absolutely.
Like that. So you were a writer, mm-hmm. you were active in the world. Don't we work on those processes at the same time?
Yes, yes. Do you work on the process of making a living in the world or even making a success in the world and finding a spiritual path? The brilliance of Rudy's work for me was that the world was the path. That's how it worked. The reason I've managed to get two paths going as one is because I saw my career as part and parcel of my spiritual development. Not as separate from it, not as the beneficiary of the spiritual path. It was my path. And it worked. It does work that way. If I had just wanted the career, I know many people who that's all they want and get it, but there's not a lot of connection to the spiritual dimension. And I've watched people kind of literally sell their soul for that stuff. And that's painful to watch. Good people who don't know what they're doing, who get all that stuff and then kind of go crazy because it doesn't satisfy. The most powerful thing about getting everything you kind of want is how little it gives. And that's, for many people, in truth, the beginning of their spiritual life. They get their fame, their success, their money, and they're still the same person with all their problems. And then they go, now what? And you start to see, they find other things. They find the Kabbalah, they find, I don't know, whatever practice they find, and some of them truly, purely embrace that, and some just take it as another thing to embellish their person. But spiritual life and material life are the exact same process. And so having a career, having a life, being successful, it's completely wanted. Rudy used to celebrate when I once got a check, I remember, and I for a first movie I was writing, and I walked into his store, and I walked down and I said, "Rudy, you want to see something real?" And I showed him the check, and he hugged me because it was real. Paid for my family, it paid the rent, did all of these things, and he celebrated my understanding that this was real. No, you don't separate from it. And a lot of people that I know who have awakened are still working daytime jobs. You still have to live your life. Of course you live your life. Will it necessarily give you fame and fortune? No, but if it does, it will still be part and parcel of the spiritual effort. And that's really important. You know, I mean, I had to go on stage the other day in Manchester to take a bow for the show. It was weird. It was weird because I have no personal sense of having done anything. I know this thing emerged through this body, mind, person. And I know all the effort and time and work that went into it. But it was always flowing through. For me to own that thing would be to misunderstand what took place. For me to stand there and go, "Yeah, I did this," would be horrible. Horrible. Be horrible for me and horrible for anybody who actually does that, because it just makes you this bigger thing to get broken down. So for me it was strange. So I just applauded everybody on stage because they're the ones who had just done all the work. My work was long ago and it wasn't even truly me. So you learn how to be empty in the face of all of that stuff, rather than to become somebody who's famous and rich and thinks you have a right to this. Because they're going to take it all away. Every bit of it is taken away. So if you haven't learned to let go of it, you're just building yourself up for a big surprise. That makes sense? Does that even answer your question?
Yeah, I guess I just sometimes wonder about, not necessarily you or anyone in particular, but some spiritual teachers who are like, you know, it's just enlightenment. It's just, you know, and that the world, you know, they're not acknowledging, you know, well, that we don't live in India,
right,
200 years ago where you, right, can sit on the side of the road with a begging bowl.
Right.
And you got to live in the world.
Right. Well, we do. There are still people in India who don't.
Right.
Who still sit by the side of the road and people fill their bowl. Thailand, monks still go out and beg for food every day and bring home the bacon or whatever they bring home. But they all, that's their journey. Ours in Western world is a little different. On the other hand, when Eckhart had his awakening, he talks about sitting on a park bench for 2 years. I don't know what he did on that park bench, but I know he didn't die of starvation. He wasn't exposed to the elements. Something still went on. You know, Buddha, when he had his enlightenment, was just sitting under a tree. And he went, "Oh." Now, none of us really know what took place after that. But my image of Buddha, and I've talked about this before, is a guy with hemorrhoids who's been sitting a long time under that tree. He's still a person. He's still an entity. He's still a being. And he still has all this stuff going on. And so we don't know the real story, but I can probably surmise he was just like us. But he was in a culture that would give him stuff. Food. Somebody would put a roof over his head. Stuff happened for Buddha because people acknowledged in the Hindu system that the extraordinary nature of somebody's awakening. There's a whole culture devoted to that. That's pretty remarkable. And then Buddha taught it, and he out through the Hindu system, he created a whole new system of people who were becoming awakened and enlightened. And what happened when Buddha became enlightened, and he talked about this all over, it was a religion formed up around it. And so you had cultures promoting enlightenment. Our culture does not promote enlightenment. Our culture promotes fame and success and wealth and all of these things in the material world, which ultimately are not satisfying. So we have to do it differently. And yes, we have to go to work, and yes, we have to do all of the things we have to do. And if you find a teacher who tells you you can leave the world and just sit in an ashram, well, you probably can. There are ashrams in India where you can just go sit. If that's your calling, go do it. I met a guy at a retreat once who was on his 30th retreat, and he had done retreats for 10 days and 30 days and 90 days, and he just went for the free food. And he sat and he got to sit every day, and they took care of him. There are ways to do it. if that's what you want. I happen to like the path Rudy presented, which is get up and go to work and take care of your responsibilities. Am I getting closer to your answer?
Yeah, I guess when I first started doing this work, I remember a long time ago my teacher saying, you know, everything is energy or a manifestation of energy or energy relationships, and so money is just that too, I would think. And in Buddhism, there's, I forget the word for it, but there's something called basically spiritual street smarts, and fame could be that as long as you're not attached to that.
Yeah, well, I mean, non-attachment is what they teach.
I mean, Eckhart was on Oprah.
Right.
He probably wasn't, like, you know, writing a goal list of, you know, get on Oprah.
Well, yeah, I can't speak for Eckhart, you know. I mean, Oprah and I talked about doing a TV show together, and then she didn't want to pay me hardly anything. So I said no. You know, because it wasn't, she wasn't being, her people were not being responsible to my needs, just hers. And, you know, everybody has their own approach to all of this. There's no judgment in it. You know, you just, your path is what is happening in front of you right now. That's your path. What is rising up in you to be done? Let it happen. What is not rising up in you? How do I deal with that? If there's absolute nothingness and hunger occurs, how do I satisfy the hunger? Something will come to tell you what to do. If nothing comes to meet your needs, you'll die. If you die, is that the greatest thing and the worst thing imaginable? There comes a point in everybody's existence where the things you want to meet your biological needs cease to come. It's called dying. If you have already let go of the body-mind connection, if you have just let go of the personality-ego entity, all that's left to go is the body, and you know completely well that it's going to go. And when it's time for it to go, it will go. But you also know that you don't go anywhere. And that is the extraordinary nature of awakening. It's the promise of Easter Sunday today. You will go. You won't like it. It will hurt. It will not be pretty. You're going to have to stop breathing. Your biological systems are going to break down. Nothing will serve you. And yet, when it's all over, you will commend your spirit to something greater. You will forgive all around you for any of their transgressions, and you will be resurrected, maybe not in the body, or maybe, but you will be resurrected, meaning you will find eternal life, because that is what you are even now. That's the promise of Christianity. It's the promise of enlightenment. This is what we all have, every one of us. So if you, in doing nothing, and just being, are not supported by the universe, if they're taking you out and you don't fight it, you're going to go the place everyone goes anyway, which is into your eternal self. So if you have work to do in the world and the world gives you work, do it. If you have nothing to do and nothing is awaiting you, sit down and see what happens. What I'm discovering in doing nothing, my emails fill up with demand, the phone rings, people call, kids need stuff, my wife wants things. All of these things keep happening, so I do it. When that stops happening, then I'll just sit, see what happens. It comes. And sometimes it's a desire to do something. Like a desire may come up to write something. That's real. So do it. What I've been told by other people who have awakened is that the universe wants more of you than you can possibly imagine. It will come up. You will be in demand. And for me, just walking around the street is working.
So I guess one final clarification is you were talking previously about being and not doing. And so in this process of making some money to pay the rent, you just be and you don't. And your emails fill up and your demand.
Try it. Rudy used to sit in the store and he needed money to pay the rent. He had a big store and a lot of goods that needed to be sold. And there were times where nobody was visiting, nobody was coming. And he would say, okay, I need to attract. And he would just sit still. And the next big buyer would walk in the door. I watched it happen over and over.
But he wasn't doing anything.
No. What can he do? Stand on the street and go, I have Buddhas for sale?
Or you can do something inside of yourself.
Do what?
Ask.
Well, yeah, you can ask. Good point. You can ask, but I'm telling you, you asking has none of the power of you being. You asking is this little tiny thing that you think is you, which is magnified in your mind into something vast. This little thing saying, I need help, help me. Being is the vastness itself, knowing what to do and knowing what you need.
So when Rudy said ask, he was asking to surrender?
Yes, you ask to surrender the small need to the larger knowing or the larger need. It's always met. It's always met. Now, you may not like the way it's met, but that's something else. The deepest truth is leading you to knowing, to awakening. One way or another, it leads you there. And sometimes it leads you there through a lot of kind of stuff. Because a lot of us are so dense, it's the only way we'll get it. But it's leading you there. There is nowhere else to go. It's all we're in pursuit of, all of us. And it's awaiting us. And it comes through, often, suffering, unfortunately. But that's how it works. I mean, I've had, my own career is full of ups and downs. And from the outside, everybody looks at somebody else's career like, oh, it's just wonderful. It's life is struggle. Life is struggle. You do what you have to do, and when you get to be old enough, I'm at this wonderful place of being old, where life doesn't demand the same things of me. I can let stuff fall away. Middle age, you can't do that. You're caught. So, be middle aged.
But can't you do that when you're middle aged?
You can work for surrender, and you can work for detachment. That's what you can do. And you can build up a structure, or Rudik would call it a muscle, that lets go. So that when this age happens, it's done. You can do it like that. You know, I let go of my career, this is just 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. I finished my last script, actually about a month or so ago. I finished my last script, I sent it off, they sent back a check. I never said a word. And this is the second time that's happened to me. I get a check, and nobody says, I liked it, I didn't like it, we have plans, we don't have plans. Done. And I said, well, you know, this is going out with a whimper. But I have no need or desire to ever be part of that world again, ever. And I feel so relieved, you have no idea. It's like the biggest weight ever has fallen off these shoulders. I don't have to do that stuff anymore. Now, I'm lucky, I don't have to do it. I worked my, however, 25 years in the business, I did my work, I'm done.